Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Happy autumnal equinox, everyone. I hope everyone has been enjoying the first few days of fall. Welcome to another episode of Nightlight. With Columbus Day right around the corner, let's delve into ancient Native history tonight. The 18th annual AAPS conference is being held in Harris, Michigan on October 6th and 7th, and tonight we'll be discussing the merits of this conference and worthy presenters. We should be having Judy Johnson, conference producer, calling in just a minute. Crystal and Wayne Trickle are here. And I was fortunate enough to work with Crystal and Ida Jane Gallagher 10 years ago when I was on another network. And you may know Ida Jane from her book, Contact with Ancient America. Let's see. Phil Leonard is here as well. And, going to be looking at a lot of the archaeoastronomy from the panhandle of Oklahoma, Kansas, southeastern Colorado. So, we don't really touch on the plains area too much. And I think by the time tonight's show's over, you're going to have a thorough understanding of what a lot of the Native cultures and possibly people from the old world were doing in that part of the country. So, hi everyone, how are you doing? Thank you for joining us.
We're doing great, Mark.
Great. Glad to hear that. Okay. I don't know if we're still waiting for Judy to call in, but, Crystal, let's start off with you have been living in Kansas for a while.
I've never been there. Yeah, I've been here for about 24 years, and I tell you, Mark, Kansas is drive-through country usually, but if you come and move here, you'll find that there's this great contribution to ancient American history sitting here in the middle of the country that we've been able to explore and delve into, and along the way, I've made a lot of friends and had some great mentors in Phil and Ida Jane both. Phil, by the way, has several books on archaeoastronomy and ancient inscriptions. But my journey here in Kansas, Mark, has been one of excitement because of the various ancient sites that are here. So I know your audience isn't familiar with the plains, but we really do have a lot to contribute to ancient American history.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the nice things about our show is, you know, when we get, I guess, like you talking about, you know, a state that is, you know, not, you know, just say high profile, you know, they want, our listeners want to learn about what's there, what makes the area unique. So, you know, let's just get into, you know, a little sample of what you have seen in Kansas, and, you know, we'll work in other people's perspectives as well. So, you know, Crystal, do you want to tell us about one of your more favorite spots to research, and we'll go from there?
Sure, Mark. We have roughly about 8 solar aligned sites here in Kansas. There are far more petroglyph sites where you will see inscriptions in the cliff faces, various rocks in Kansas. You know, we're known as the plains. We don't have an abundant source of rocks here in Kansas, but we do have some rocky outcrops along the riverways, the creek banks, various places. And some of these places, ancient peoples were able to make solar-aligned features so that they could track time. They were, in essence, creating calendars out in the plains with what the elements provided. You know, if you lived in Stonehenge, you could mine the Preseli bluestones from a few hundred miles away in Wales,
right,
and haul them over and make this wonderful monument. But here in the plains, people use small rock shelters or cliff faces, and they would shape the outside of the cave or cliff face so that on, say, like the equinox, sunrise or sunset, or one of the solstice days, whichever way that pointed, to be able to create a calendar to keep time. We all are just fascinated with what time it is. So the ancient peoples that were here, whether they were native peoples or people from other old world countries that made contact, they were able to know the angle of the sun, the height, and exactly where the sun would be to create these calendars in stone. And they didn't just do it with a straight line or, something simple. Some of them are very elaborate shadow displays. You remember as a kid, you know, doing the little shadow puppets with your hands? Well, these ancient peoples would create an elaborate shadow display to make an ancient motion picture. Yeah, they were very artistic as well as ingenuitive. You know, you probably had some engineers and things that had a lot of ability, but the artistry that they used is fascinating because they didn't just track the day of the year. They did it in such a way that it added to the story, or it's a major feature of that alignment. So you're really looking at the oldest ancient motion pictures that there are when you see these sites.
Okay, let's bring in Ida Jane for a minute. Ida Jane, you document your studies of this material in your book, Contact with Ancient America. you know, you've visited many places around the world. It's just filled with photos. You were adopted into one of the
Quinnipiac.
I'm sorry, I mispronounced that. Tribe, is that right? So you're working with people from all kinds of backgrounds from around the world to put your book together. We worked together October 4th of 2011. Can't believe it's been that long. But what have you learned about the human condition with the interest in archaeoastronomy from around the world? What does it reveal about us?
Ancient people were not stupid. They were sophisticated in terms of being able to tell the time of the year and what have you through astronomy. And I might mention a particular part of my research. I'm a native West Virginian, and in 1982, Arnett Hyde, who edited wonderful West Virginia magazine, called me about a petroglyph in Wyoming County, West Virginia. And the reason he called me was I had written several articles for the magazine on the burial mounds in West Virginia and Ohio that have inscribed tablets. Robert Pyle, Virginia archaeologist, had photographed and had been working at a Wyoming County, West Virginia petroglyph site. And he was fascinated by it and wanted to preserve it. Well, just in the past few weeks, the Register Herald in Beckley, West Virginia, has picked up on this article again, trying to get the railroad that runs near the petroglyph to preserve the site. So it's been years now. We were trying to preserve our ancient history. My article appeared in wonderful West Virginia in 1983, along with Pyle's section of the archaeology of the site. And we enlisted Dr. Barry Fell to work on the writings. In the petroglyphs, and they are an alphabet called Ogham, which is very widespread. It's well known in Ireland, but that's not the earliest time. And the articles in wonderful West Virginia stirred up a lot of controversy. And the total information on that is in my book. But the petroglyph, when translated, it is aligned with the winter solstice sunrise. And it is a Christian message talking about the birth of Christ. And Dr. Fell became interested in this because of a Chi Rho symbol that appeared on the petroglyphs, and that keyed him to know that it had a religious significance. So
the Cairo is the symbol in the Christian church for the name Christ. So the full account of this appears in my book. Also, in Ohio and West Virginia, the stone tablets that were found inscribed in the mounds are of interest, and particularly the Old Hebrew. By coincidence, this is the Hebrew festival of harvest, the Sukkot, and the Hebrew tablets that came out of the Hopewell Mounds in Ohio have been studied and deciphered by a number of Hebrew scholars. One in particular has a drawing of Moses, and he is so named on the tablet, and the Ten Commandments are inscribed around that. So there's a great deal of information from these areas. Phil might pick up on the Ogham alphabet because he knows a lot about it, but it is widespread in the world.
Okay. Phil, do you want to take over for Ida Jane and get into the Ogham alphabet, please?
Surely. It's generally believed that the Irish invented the Ogham alphabet. There's a problem with that, though, in that we have inscriptions that predate the time that the Irish are supposed to have invented it. And on top of that, there's one of the versions, there are various versions of Ogham. It can look like trees, it can look like vertical strokes, it can look like circles. The Druids had different ways of camouflaging their writing so that others would not know what they were saying. That's why there were different versions of it. But they have names for each of the letters, and they name them different ways. One of the ways is using tree names. And one of the tree names for the Ogham alphabet, the tree does not occur in Ireland or England. And so it kind of throws a wrench in the works for saying that the Irish invented the Ogham, because the tree only appears down in the Black Sea, in the area of the Black Sea, not in the water, but on the shores and in the country surrounding the Black Sea. So a long ways from Ireland. And we have inscriptions that in America that have been dated to a time before the Ogham alphabet was supposedly invented in Ireland. And they have symbols that are duplicates of what occurs in the area of the Black Sea, specifically in the town of Trebizond.
Okay. Phil, since gave us an example of the range of where the ancient writings have been found. People are going to have to be some people are going to be bringing these ideas with them to America. What route are they taking to get to Kansas? Out there in the central part of the country, you know, what evidence do we have of them, you know, getting to that point, and how are they getting there?
All right, I'll be glad to do that, but I'd like to mention that Ida Jane has been working with us. We've been working together for nearly 40 years, and Ida Jane has been a great contributor to the work that we've been doing and what we've published. And Crystal's, we've been working with Crystal now for over a decade, and she's been a hard worker doing a lot of things to further the cause. But now, how did the people get here? Well, the ocean and waterways are highways. They're not barriers. If we think of the French traders, the fur traders, they didn't walk across America. They paddled their canoes up the rivers and streams to get where they were going because they could carry cargo inside the canoe, and they could use the water to move more rapidly than they could climb mountains and do it that way. And so there's an example that supports the concept that the waterway is a highway rather than a barrier. Now, if you leave the Black Sea and you travel through the Mediterranean outside of what was called the Pillars of Hercules, that's the Rock of Gibraltar, and across the Atlantic Ocean, the currents will bring you here to America, and that's what Christopher Columbus did, was he allowed the current and the trade winds to bring him to America and to the Caribbean and islands. And apparently that's what a number of people did of various cultures coming to the New World. And you can enter the Mississippi, come up to the Arkansas River, and head west on the Arkansas River, which goes right along the border of Kansas and Oklahoma. And before the European settlers and pioneers that we are descendant of plowed the prairie held water much more efficiently than it does now, so that the waterways were higher, had deeper waters than they do now. And, of course, 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, the Arkansas River didn't have dams across it. So they were able to freely paddle up the Arkansas River clear into Colorado, where the Arkansas River begins. Now, there are, Ogham has been found in Spain, in Oklahoma, in Kansas, in Colorado, and West Virginia, several places in the United States, and of course, it's found in England and Ireland, and in some in France.
Oh, okay. And Crystal, in a video you recently made of your presentation at a church. Yeah, you had some photos in there of Tim Severn's Brandon boat from boat from his 1976 voyage. It's amazing seeing that at the Craig and Allen Museum. But there's your proof that leather boat can make it across the Atlantic, you know, like Phil was just saying, you know, coming from, you know, like the Gulf of Mexico and up the rivers, and you know, just keep going. So, you know, can you tell us? Do you want to expand a little bit more on the inland sailing that seems pretty obvious that was going on?
Well, Mark, let me just say it to you the easiest way. I try to keep a running tally of people who have rowed rowboats by themselves across the Atlantic. My count is up to 29 individual people who have by themselves rowed a rowboat across the Atlantic Ocean from either the British Isles or the west coast of Europe. So it's not that difficult for people to do ocean crossings. The last account I saw was a young man for charity that rowed a rowboat all the way across the Atlantic. So it's not that much of a stretch then to see these great waterways that Phil said were highways. And here in the interior part of Kansas, in north central Kansas where we live, we're not very far from that great bend of the Arkansas River. There are some other smaller rivers, such as the Saline River, that runs just north of that we do find quite a lot of sites at. But ancient peoples, these were navigable rivers before the dam project. And so what we've done is search these riverways for any cliff faces to look for petroglyphs and then try to discern if there might be a solar alignment there. And so we found various ancient scripts. There's, you know, a few of them. But that's kind of the method that we've used to begin our search. And this was years ago with a man named Keith Jeffries that was kind enough to show us some of the sites that he'd found, and we've added to that list. But, Mark, if 29 individuals can row a rowboat across the Atlantic, I don't think that the ancient peoples had that difficult of a time if they had a seaworthy enough vessel. Those oxhide little boats like Brendan had, the courage that they used, they were very readily repaired if there was a tear in the side of the ship. Now, a wooden ship, if it hit ice, would probably get a hole and sink. But because of the ability to repair the little boat like Brendan, the Keurig, they could take the northerly route where there were icebergs. So I'm not sure if that really answers your question, but just to get into the interior part of America, you have that ability to take the river systems and then veer off into other creeks or waterways. So that's what we've done here. I know that's the method that other people have used, and maybe have I answered your question?
Yeah, that's fine. And I just wanted to bring.
Yes, and Mark, what we do here is
one of the tributaries to the Arkansas River is the Cimarron, and on this Cimarron branch, there has been located a large drawing in the bedrock. Very long ago, because it's very heavily passinated. That's the coating that builds itself over inscriptions over a period of time. And it was found by an archaeologist by the name of Weisendonger. And it's a ship that I have shown to a maritime archaeologist, and she has dated it to about the time of Christ. It's a sailing ship. It shows the sails, the brails that are on the sails. It shows the steerboard, which, you know, we get the term today of starboard. It comes from steerboard because the steerboard was always attached to the right side of the ship.
And, did not know that.
It shows a steerboard is clearly visible on that ship and has been identified by a maritime archaeologist that is familiar with Middle Eastern ships. And in fact, there were some friends of Ida Jane's and myself that the Wilsons who went to Italy and saw a display of ancient Rome trading with other peoples and using those ships were going back and forth to Rome at that time. The same kind of ship that we have drawn anciently in Oklahoma. And
okay.
I might add that there's another site that deals with Ogham and is described with Ogham, and it is a triple planetary conjunction in the constellation, the Noble Twins. And it has been dated by Evans and Sutherland using the Digistar computer, which is a star projector that many planetariums use. And they match this to August 8th of 471 AD with Ogham inscription in America.
Okay. So now we're really getting into the archaeoastronomy now with the planetary conjunction of 471 AD. So, crystal is, we have that date. Other dates have you been able to determine when transatlantic people are here in America? We can go back to some of the native cultures. You know, how many other dates have you been able to find? By looking at something like a planetary conjunction?
Well, I'm fairly confident, Mark, in Cave 1 at Anubis Cave. The first cave has a series, two separate walls, and the one, Phil can explain the westerly facing constellations there. But on the north-south facing wall, Mark, there's this fascinating inscription that has a big plus mark in the center and to the left a plus mark and then a diagonal group of plus marks that form the belt stars of Orion with a Jupiter-Saturn conjunction that would have taken place on the morning of around September the 24th, 470 A.D., and these Jupiter-Saturn conjunctions were, by many ancient peoples, they were watched closely because they're easier to watch along with Venus. But I feel pretty confident about that because there were four separate astronomers, professional astronomers, that when that was presented to them at Anubis Caves, they got their cell phones out and pulled up their astronomical apps, and they agreed with that they could see that was a Jupiter-Saturn conjunction above Orion. And so that's a date, and I feel pretty good about that as far as four other astronomers agreeing. Then there's some other cupules that are representational of constellations that may go back quite a lot further. And we have one here in Kansas that may have Draco depicted when the pole star was in Draco. They at least drew the constellations in the quadrants of the sky. So you may be in the BC era, but those are things that we have a pretty good idea of. Ida Jane, do you have anything like that with your research that you've done?
Well, the Cairo symbols on the West Virginia petroglyph, Cairo symbols can be fairly well dated. And Barry Fell dated those in about the 6th century A.D. So that gives an idea of dating of the Wyoming County, West Virginia petroglyph.
Okay, thanks.
Well, cool.
I think if you're looking for dates that go back in time prior to Columbus, we have something that goes even before the time of Christ that can be dated. And that is, there are some inscriptions which I have published in a journal. The title of the journal is Pre-Columbiana, a Journal of Long-Distance Contacts. And it is edited by Professor Stephen Jett, emeritus of University of California, Davis. And in that article, which I co-authored with a fellow that is from the nation of Oman, and his name is Ali Ahmed Al-Shahri, and he had heard that I had inscriptions here in America that match the inscriptions that he has been finding for the last two decades in Oman. And the alphabet was used at a time roughly spanning 300 BC to 100 AD. And that is the alphabet that is standing next to the ship that I had described and with the sails and the steerboard and that sort of thing. It is a 60-foot-long inscription next to that ship.
Okay, and Phil, since we've been talking a little bit about Anubis Cave, you participated in the episode in which Scott Walter, studied that cave, for the summer solstice, or I forget what time he was there. The equinox. Can you tell us a little bit about what Scott was doing on that episode? What was his purpose for analyzing the Anubis Cave?
Well, it is without him stating very specifically what his purpose was, it appeared fairly clear to me that he saw that as an important cave and alignment, the contents of the caves. There's actually five caves there. And the caves have inscriptions that are very important and very revealing as to what belief system the perpetrators of those that put the inscriptions there, what their belief system was, and that gave us a clue as to where they were from, along with the fact that they had writing and some other things there. And he felt that it was important, at least he said so to me, that it was a very important cave system, and that he felt it was important to record it and to show it to the people, the general public.
Okay. Or, Phil will come back to you in a minute, but Judy is here. So, Judy, you have Crystal doing a great job discussing archaeoastronomy. Who else do you have lined up for your conference this year? Is Judy on mute?
Judy?
Mark?
Yes.
She speaks so softly, the connection is so bad, you can barely hear her. So, and she's called in twice. So, if she's calling in on a cell phone, maybe she should use a landline, but you can't hear her.
Okay. I'll let her know. Phil, you were just talking about, the belief system. We were talking earlier about Dr. Fell's belief in the religious significance of the writings, and Ida Jane was just talking about the Cairo symbols. How much of what everyone has been researching is really some kind of monument about many different faiths?
There certainly is, Mark. There's certainly different faiths. We could take you right over here in Kansas and show you about a 4-foot-tall representation of Baal or Baal, the ancient Phoenician and Celtic god Baal. Various other things. But when you go out through Kansas, you'll find different things. But I'm going to tell you, in the Oklahoma Panhandle, that southeastern Colorado region, you have this great mixture of ancient American inscriptions of Native peoples, but also some very unique inscriptions that Phil can get into that actually have kind of a mysterious, and Ida Jane knows this as well. Let them elaborate on it, Mark. Let them tell you about it.
Okay. Ida Jane, do you want to continue with your observations?
Well, I've observed a lot of things throughout the world. And in New England, we have many stone structures that are comparable to things you find in Ireland and in Europe. They call them chambers, and many are solar aligned.
Okay. They're mostly oriented towards the sun.
Excuse me. Many of them are. They find this in other parts of the world, too. even South Africa. And South Africa has Ogham inscriptions. And I'm sorry, my voice is giving out on me.
So you had worked with Credo Mutwa there, Ida Jane?
Yes.
Yeah, Dr. Credo Mutwa, the Zulu witch doctor that had an Ogham inscribed relics?
Yes.
Okay. What did you learn from Dr. Fredo?
I'm sorry. They also use the Ogham alphabet there. And when he saw photos of our chambers, he said they have the same thing in South Africa.
Hmm. Okay, and you also document like Maze Howe. You've traveled pretty extensively, seeing equinoxes and solar as well as other celestial depictions. What were the people saying when they were made, some of the petroglyphs were made thousands of years ago?
What were people saying?
Go ahead, Crystal.
Well, sometimes, Mark, they were talking about their religious ideology. You see, among the Celtic peoples, that they had certain days, 8 specific days throughout the solar year, the year that they would keep track of these solar dates for festivals. You've heard of May Day or Beltane.
Right.
Those
mm-hmm.
would be what you would call a cross-quarter day, which is simply the day between, like in May, the spring equinox to the summer solstice. Then summer solstice would be another day. They may worship a lot of these. For the Celts that we see here in Kansas have to do with harvest. Some of them are fertility rites or symbols, but there's an intricate use of those cross-quarter days that you don't just find everywhere in the world, but they're mostly harvest festivals. And to certain deities like Lug or for Lunasa, which is a cross-quarter day in August, was a celebration of what the Celts called the Hungry Month, when it was just about that time to cut the season's grain to store up for the winter time or your fall harvest. And those sorts of things, you might see inscriptions about where to travel or how to get to the next place on your journey, various things like that. But Phil has done extensive research in the Anubis cave complexes that have to do with a secret religious system, Mark, that he has deciphered. Why don't you let him just tell you quickly about that?
Okay. Phil, lay it on us.
Okay. The Anubis caves contain depictions of elements of a religion called Mithraism. Mithraism mm-hmm. began before 1000 BC, earlier than that. And the Rig Veda books of ancient India record hymns to Mithras, the god that is displayed in the caves at the Anubis caves in Oklahoma. The god was spread from there to Persia and from Persia to Asia Minor, and eventually the Greeks and the Romans took it over, and the Romans completely changed, not completely, significantly changed the iconography, the pictures and storytelling elements of Mithraism. What we have in America is not Roman Mithraism. It is the earlier form that comes from Asia Minor around the Black Sea, and we have duplicate elements repeated there. As a matter of fact, we have in Southeast Colorado and the Oklahoma Panhandle, we have a word for the light of the sun. It's called grion, and that word appears first in Sanskrit thousands of years before it ever appeared here anciently in America. And the religion of the Anubis caves is Mithraism, but the Mithraism of Asia Minor and of Persia. And some detractors of the concept say, well, it doesn't match the Mithras, Mithraeum, the temple of Mithras in Rome or in, say, Germany or Hungary. And because of that, they say it can't be. But it does match the Mithraeums of Syria and Asia Minor and Persia. And that it matches very well, along with the...
Okay,
go ahead.
So Phil, you, when you were working on, you know, that episode of America's Unearthed, you know, I think Scott was taking more of the angle that the inscriptions at the Anubis cave were more closely related to, he said, Syria than, say, Rome.
Well, the Asian version of Mithraism, which was the original version of Mithraism, it originated in India and eventually was picked up by Persia and then to Syria and Asia Minor, Turkey. And it was pretty much the same in those regions, the same as what we have in Oklahoma.
But there's these little hidden elements there, Mark. There's these little tiny inscriptions that in cave 2 at Anubis that are just very small, maybe 3 inches tall, some of them, and others as well. But Phil was able to decipher those elements. He spent years on that, and I just think he should really be applauded for it, just like Ida Jane with her vast research, worldwide research, but to be brave enough to go investigate those West Virginia petroglyphs, even though both of these people, I do want you to know, both of them have been severely persecuted by the academic world for no reason. Their research is sound. You have wonderful researchers. That's why I've sought them out to be mentors for me, because I wanted quality research that I could understand and learn, you know, as you go along your journey in life. You have to have someone to teach you how to see what you're looking at in archaeoastronomy. You can use a compass or whatever, but there's just nothing like the hands-on approach. And both of them have been persecuted at times for what they have discovered and published, but the research they've done is sound. It's quality research that I would invite anyone to look into and delve into. People can learn a lot from what they've written.
And
these little petroglyphs, Mark, they're fascinating. If you get a chance, Scott Monahan, who's deceased now, he died a little over a year ago, but if you can find Scott Monahan's work, his video productions on the caves and some other sites in the Panhandle and southeastern Colorado, he did some work out here in Kansas as well. But his work is good. I'll just throw Scott Monahan in here. I know everyone's familiar with Scott Walter, But years ago, Scott did a lot of video documentation that was very well done. And so I would encourage anyone to find it.
Okay. And Ida Jane does have a sample of Dr.
Credo Mutwa?
Yeah, Mutwa's three alphabets on a slate he used for instructional purposes. The Ogham alphabet is shown with its equivalent signs in Kufic, Arabic, and Egyptian hieroglyphs. Okay, there's some similarities there. And there's you were able to link it to the Calendar One site. I think that's in Vermont.
Right.
Okay, can you explain a little bit of that, Ida Jane, please?
The Calendar One site. has a stone chamber in it, and it is aligned for the equinox. But there is a point in the field where you can stand and view the mountain in front of you, and there are standing stones on it and other items where you can mark where the sun's going to rise. So it's a solar site.
Wow, okay. We need do we have Wayne?
Yeah, Wayne's right Mark.
Wayne, what do you think of all this?
Well, Mark, it's fascinating to see this ancient alphabet that's been used in various parts of the world showing up right here in the U.S., even in the central part. I think that Crystal does an excellent job on some of her presentations as showing the ability of these ancient people to travel. They were very intelligent. They knew the stars and the sun and the moon, the planets. They would be able to navigate up these systems and in search of, you know, who knows what. They were explorers, perhaps, like we've had in recent history, you know, Lewis and Clark. They went out and explored these the United States all the way to the coast. So people have always been excited about exploration. Maybe they were looking for minerals. Maybe they were just looking for trading. I know there has been a lot of mention about the copper trade and all the copper that's up in the, you know, in the Great Lake area that was probably used to trade, especially during the Bronze Age. So I think it's fascinating. I think there's been a lot of travelers here to the U.S. that's in far long ago times when before, and we're just discovering that they did leave their mark here. They did leave their alphabets here and their marks and their religious holidays, and so that we know that they were absolutely here and pretty well documented.
I'm sure it's, you know, the copper is going to come up at the conference on October 6th and 7th. A lot of people talk about the transportation of copper down, you know, right down the Mississippi River to Cahokia. It really seems like Cahokia had a major influence radiating out from, you know, basically the St. Louis area across the country. You know, it seems like, you know, when we do the AAPS discussions, you know, Cahokia usually comes up. You know, does anyone want to touch on the importance of Cahokia?
Crystal might have something on that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of major trade that went on there. You can see how close it is to the water. You see, what is there, about 100 mounds, small mounds there, that large mound.
Mm-hmm.
Several of them are aligned to the sun, rising and setting. Lunar major minor standstills may be there. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I know that you have the mound complexes there that show the mound people with this intricate knowledge of the movements of the heavens along with that trading route. And when you look at Cahokia, that it was fortified the way that it was, you can tell that they were protecting themselves and did a lot of trade. You see, even among the serpent cult that Dr. Mahan called it in that area, and trade, they talked about trade all the way down into Mexico from there, which isn't really unheard of or outstanding. But I think for us, Mark, from Cahokia kind of outward, we've all had our own research areas from that central focus point kind of out, east, west, north, south. And you guys have been Copper Country have looked, you know, for the trade routes north to south, and where did your copper go? And those of us in the plains here are just following the track of people. And I'm sure Cahokia played a major part. I did talk with a Lakota Sioux after one of the talks I gave at a local college, and he talked with me and told me that his people in ancient times would come. They had various places that they would stop at trading routes, and down south of Wichita, Kansas, there was a huge settlement of Native people. They're actually excavating that now because they found that's a battlefield with the Spanish. But he talked to me and said that they know these places, and he said if he just saw pictures of the petroglyphs, if they were Native, he was very familiar with like the Pawnee symbolism, his own people's symbolism, and various peoples, because they have kept that alive among some of them, but they're just not open about sharing that information until trust is gained. So, just fascinating.
Yeah, and there's actually a site down here that we've looked at. It's in the southern central part of Kansas that has some Ogham inscriptions there, and a large spring, very nice place if you had to live there for long periods of time. And they found a stone there that was they were using to build pipes with, and it was the stone that come, it was not native to here, but it come from Minnesota. So you can see that there was a lot of trade around in the country from the north to the south, and I'm sure that those Cahokia Mounds are quite a central hub, and they were very large, probably a large trading center being right on the Mississippi.
Okay.
And that's what Wayne's talking about is the divide here in Kansas for the Great Plains area, the upper and lower drainage of the Arkansas River is near there, and there's actually not too far away of Kansas. We have our own serpent mound. It's not a mound that's piled up high. It's a reverse mound, an intaglio that's cut into the ground, the serpent with the egg in its mouth here. And that's not very far from here. That's included in our research because there were these three council circles that were involved with the serpent that creates a 3-4-5 triangle, which shows an advanced use of mathematics along with that serpent that had solar alignments connected to it. So it's just fascinating to see the ancient world.
Crystal, since you were just talking about the divide where the rivers are running north and south, have you noticed like anything where that's like a power center? Like, when Maria Wheatley's been a guest with us, she's spoken about some of the underground like water features that might be associated with the rivers running by just say Avebury or near other ley lines. Are you finding unique geographical features being a place of interest to the ancient native cultures or recent?
Yeah, there's actually, you have features here. Water is a significant feature. And, a competent dowser that can find water running underground. But here in Kansas, mm-hmm. that's something that we find a lot here is a water feature with the inscription. That's common. And maybe at some of the sites, if they are solar aligned, you have a place that would create like a natural amphitheater as well. I know Ida Jane's been very involved with some dowsers in the New England sites up in that area, Betty Sensorbow and various other people that she knows quite a lot about that as well. But here we always find water nearby. That's an important thing in this part of the country here in the plains, because you're getting into the drier desert area the further west you go. So water was extremely important, and game migrations and the game trails and things, people needed water to live. So that's a very important feature that we find, springs or things of that nature. And
okay.
Salt—that's the big thing here, Mark—is salt.
Nope. Food preservation.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a fascinating subject too. The various ingenious too to preserve. Foods, if you're a nomadic person, and it's amazing how they figured out all this kind of stuff, like the use of salt.
Yeah, very much so, and that is as much an important aspect of staying alive as anything.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, do you mind if I just quickly ask Phil and Ida Jane one quick question?
Go right ahead.
Hey, guys, I just want to know, I've never really asked you guys this, but what did both of you think the first time that you watched a solar alignment? What was your first impression? I know you've done deep research. Phil was part of a group effort. Mark, that he had Bill McGlone, an engineer, avid researcher. Rollin Gillespie was a NASA scientist. Phil, very good with linguistics. They had a great team working there. And Ida Jane's a trained journalist. And Scott Monahan has worked with Phil and his group to record the work they did. And Ida Jane's able to do that with her prolific writing over the years. But I'd like to just ask them both, what their first impression and maybe their lasting impression with seeing solar aligned sites and how they felt in the beginning and how they feel about them now. Can
I'll
you talk out of Jane?
Out of Jane.
I'll try. The Wyoming County, West Virginia site from Dr. Feld's translation, we knew that there must be a winter solstice alignment. And I positioned myself, we knew where the sun would rise over the mountains. And we thought it would go through a small notch in the corner of the cave. And that was my first experience. I saw it go through the notch, and I photographed it. And when it went through the notch, it struck a sun symbol and then just slowly washed across the whole petroglyph, which is probably 10 feet long. And that was very impressive. And I think I was the first person to ever see that and photograph it. And it was very exciting. And my photos are in wonderful West Virginia magazine and also in my book.
Okay.
Awesome. What about you, Phil?
Well, when I was growing up, we were taught by the adults that about the winter solstice, the summer solstice, the equinoxes, and how to tell when they occurred by the shadows, how to tell time, the daily time, hour of the day, by using the shadows. And that was kind of an everyday thing for us. What really struck me most was when we found writing that forecast the alignment, and then the alignment happened. Now, that was really exciting.
I'm sure. That was at Crack Cave, was it? Or was it at Anubis?
Well, no, before Crack Cave or before Anubis, there was the Sun Temple.
Oh, that's correct.
And,
yes.
And reading the writing there that told us when and how the alignment would occur, and having that confirmed by the Digistar projector with the triple planetary conjunction, It all came together, and it was very exciting to have that complex of things come together.
I bet it was.
Okay, and Ida Jane,
yes?
Aside from the visual images of, you know, the solstice, you know, we were just talking about, you know, in your book, you know, Contact with Ancient America, you know, you do have, you know, photos of many of these sites we've been, you know, discussing. You know, you visited there too. But you know, you also have a photo of the, is that the Mic, am I saying right, the Mi'kmaq language that was written on a paper, you know, you document it. You know, it's really interesting to have an early sample of what the native written language. You know, you preserve the sample of that for us. Can you tell us a little bit about your observations of that kind of artwork or self-expression in the writing that is on your page 35?
I don't know what's on 35. I don't have it in front of me. But,
it's the Mi'kmaq prayer book, Ida Jane, from the French missionaries to it's a transcription of a Bible, a prayer book, in the Mi'kmaq hieroglyphic writing system. So he's talking about the syllabary.
That's in the New England Antiquities Research Association library, and Betty Centerbo obtained that. I also I saw a photograph when I lived in New Fairfield, Connecticut, of a deed that the landowners or the settlers that wanted to settle New Fairfield signed a deed, and the deed they signed it with the local native people, and when I saw the signatures on the deed, I knew that the Native Americans had a syllabary, because the characters were syllables. And I sent that off to Dr. Fell, who was able to decipher it. But the names, the Native Americans had signed the deed with a syllabary that represented either their names or their positions in the tribe. So that led me to do a chapter of the book on Native American deeds and treaties. And the Native Americans did have writing systems, and a lot of them in the Northeast are in the Algonquian languages. So,
wow. No, I that's just, I think one of the fascinating takeaways from tonight's discussion is the various ways that people had expressed their thoughts through some type of writing system or artistic motifs.
It probably started with pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of a shortcut, a representation of the picture would be a character. And syllabary developed that way. Instead of single letters, a syllabary is one part of a word. I'm sorry.
Hey, Mark. Hey,
yes.
Phil's done some exquisite research into an ancient alphabet in Colorado and Oklahoma Panhandle area. It goes several places. out west even further, but it's this Dofari script from Oman. Hey, Phil, tell him about that, would you, about that script and the five Native American tribes with the blood antigens?
That sounds interesting. Okay.
The 3 years ago, the Saudi Arabian media sent a TV crew here, and they did an hour-long documentary on the inscriptions that we found here, because the incense, frankincense trail going from Oman up through Saudi Arabia to the Mediterranean coastline and from there over to Rome, they have some of the same inscriptions there. And Dr. Al-Thib of Riyadh University is working with us to try to decipher the inscriptions. The problem is the language appears to be a dead language that has not had any surviving books that would tell you something, you know, write it in more than one language so that you could understand this unknown, undeciphered script. But at any rate, we find that there is a human lymphocyte antigen. It's kind of a DNA. And you are born with it. You can't acquire it any other way other than from your parents. And this human lymphocyte antigen, B21, is the highest. It's a very rare antigen. It doesn't occur hardly anywhere in the world, except a few places. The greatest place is the heel and sole of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. About 22% of the people have that antigen there. The next highest place is across the Red Sea at the Horn of Africa. There are a few tribes people there that have it. And then the next highest place in the world is right here in the southwestern United States with the Utah Aztecan people.
Hmm.
Now, how did they get it? Because the Native Americans are supposed to have come across the Bering Straits and down the coast to their present location. But
yeah, from Asia to North America.
Yes. Thousands of miles away from Saudi Arabia.
Yep.
But we have the ship next to the inscriptions, and the ship is a Middle Eastern ship. It's not an Asian script ship. But on top of that, there is a Professor Brian Stubbs of the College of Eastern Utah. And he has spent a lifetime collecting the vocabulary of Utah Aztecan people. And he has found, he's published that work, and he has found that in the Utah Aztecan language, and they are the people who have this HLA B21, this rare antigen, they also have over 1,000 Semitic words in their language.
Wow.
Okay, you know, when we've had, you know, like David Brody on, you know, maybe a couple other guests, they've mentioned some of this unique DNA, like from the Basque region of Spain. You also get some of the the Basque words seem like they go back to, Neanderthal, caveman type time periods.
The Basque were probably some of the earliest people in Europe, certainly before the Indo-Europeans that we descend from.
It's really a fascinating study when you look at these DNA traits, and it's like, how does an area thousands of miles away end up being in this one from people in this one location? What everyone's been presenting tonight, it sounds like so many people in ancient times knew America was here, and were coming to America for various reasons.
Well, yes. It gets even more complicated because we have the Smithsonian Institute, and let's see if I can remember her name, Mary. She and her husband, they were archaeologists for the Smithsonian, and they excavated in South America and found that there's Jomon pottery. The Jomon people lived in Japan, and they lived there before the Japanese. They were early, like the Ainu people, an earlier culture than the arrivals from the coast of China and that became the Japanese. Now, they dated that pottery to 3200 BC. And that pottery, samples of that pottery are on display in San Francisco at the San Francisco Museum of Natural History. And it's very unique, and it can't be mistaken for someone else's pottery. So we have people coming from Asia here. We have Indian temples in southern India where the figurines of various avatars are holding ears of maize in their hand, and that maize can be identified by counting the kernels and rows of kernels. They can tell you exactly which species of maize each of the statues are holding. They're holding several species of maize from South America.
Wow.
And we have the work of Nancy Yaw Davis with the Zuni Indians, showing that the Zunis, who used to live on the California coast, but now live on the border of New Mexico, Arizona, that they not only have the religious iconography and the religious beliefs, many of the religious beliefs, not a total, but a blend of Native American and Japanese religious beliefs, and they also have the dentition. Their teeth bear the same characteristics as Asiatic and Japanese teeth. And her work has been published. It's called The Zuni Enigma by Nancy Yaw Davis. So there are many people who have encountered these oddities that some people refuse to believe exist, and these are all well-credentialed people, and they are recognized in their field as being worthwhile individuals, researchers should be paid attention to. And then all of a sudden, the minute they say the wrong word, it's, well, we're not sure we accept that. Because they didn't get taught by their professor in the college that it was so or even possible. And they have to speak the party line or they lose their grant money.
And that's certainly true. I'm
yeah,
sure
we've heard that. That's a common problem in ancient studies. But I'm glad everyone's here making their points for what actually was going on in America, you know, with all kinds of people here for thousands of years. And let's see who. Crystal, do you know, Wayne May is a scheduled speaker. I'm sure. He can get into all kinds of these types of topics. Do you know what? Any of the other speakers will be discussing?
Well, I think that, let me see, Mark, I did know that. I think that some will discuss the copper trade, of course, up there. I think there will be various speakers. The other, Arlen, that you know, that was going
Arlen
to
Andrews.
Be another person, yeah, to talk about archaeoastronomy. He has some illness with his wife and unfortunately can't make it, but I see here on the flyer that there's some ancient stones, the Jackson Man stones, some native wisdom, various things, and the copper, of course, and someone's going to talk about Göbekli Tepe and the earliest North American visitor, so it sounds fascinating. I hope the canvas and material that I have, and we'll add some of the other things that we've talked about tonight in with my PowerPoint to discuss that. But I know that Lee Pennington talks a lot about the Welsh and the ancient Welsh travels and things. He's researched civilizations in many, many places. He's went to South America quite a lot and done several documentaries down there. So it looks like kind of a mixed bag, so to speak, of various speakers that sound like we'll have a diverse group of topics that seem very interesting. I'm sure that the Kansas material will fit well within that, and the Oklahoma and Colorado sites that I'll incorporate and show the intelligence of ancient peoples as well, Mark. So
okay,
I wish Judy's phone call would have worked so she could tell you more about that.
She'll get the archive tomorrow. Yeah, there seemed like there was a tech issue. But, Wayne, are you going to be running the projector?
Yeah, he always does that like he did in the video, Mark. I'm never smart enough to remember to bring the remote, so he has to press the button. He's the chief button presser among the two of us.
Yep, that's what I'm famous for.
Okay. Okay, Wayne, are you going to be talking, or you're just manning the PowerPoint presentation?
Yeah, I think I'll just be doing that mostly. Crystal's a great speaker, so anybody who gets a chance to see her, they'll find that out. She's good. She's good at speaking and very knowledgeable on this, so it'll be a good time.
Yeah, are you driving as well?
No, we're going to fly, Mark. We'll fly up there and take the shuttle to the hotel because we need to hurry up and get back home. But for the show tonight, I don't want to cut you off at all, Mark. You've been a very generous host, but I can see that Ida Jane's having some voice problems, and Phil's got a lot of information. He can fill 20, 30 books with what he's got in his head, and so can Ida Jane. And so you know what you've done for me tonight, Mark, is you've given me a chance to enjoy the show with two of the people that are the most important to me as far as teaching me about ancient American history and letting me just, you know, sponge information from them. I feel that they've been very kind to me and teaching me things that I've wanted to learn. So thank you for letting us be on your platform for the night.
Okay. What, does anyone just want to wrap now? And, you know, we could do this another time. I mean, probably
Let's get together again, Mark. Let's get together with these guys again, and let's have some prepared stuff, and let's talk again soon.
Okay. We'll do that. Have a great time at the conference. And I just want to thank everyone for being our guest tonight. And if you want to learn more about the AAPS conference, you can go to aapscopper.com, and you know, all of the contact information and you know, banner for the speakers is there. So, you know, Barbara, you can you know, wind things down and